An Indian man, a dark-skinned Indian man. 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 An Indian man.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with a returning guest, Pill Eater. Pill Eater, great having you back on.
Thanks for having me back on, Robert. It's great to be back on again.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein.
Great to talk to you guys. It's been a really long time since I've talked to you, so I'm really happy to touch base again.
Yep, I like what you have to say, Alex.
Thank you.
So we just played a sample of your music.
Yes, that's a very funny one. It's Jared Taylor. And it's, he's saying a dark-skinned Indian man, and I just couldn't get that sample out of my head, so I had to make that song about it, so that ditty. So,
when did you first read Jared Taylor?
I first read Jared Taylor actually in college. I read Shadows of the Rising Sun about how Japanese people are different; they cannot assimilate with white people, and I just thought, wow, what a great argument. I mean, it simply does. It comes from definitely a time when I guess Neuromancer was big, and when everyone, the West, thought Japan would rule over the Western society and become this kingpin, when in fact that didn't really happen. That was just a flirty fascination. And in some strange respect, Jared Taylor's Shadow of the Rising Sun, his very first book, pretty much carved his way for being a could-have-been Japanese academic and saying that, hey, Japanese people have values that are incompatible with whites, and it should be that way, where whites should understand that from a distance. And it's an interesting book, and it certainly definitely makes me really like Jared Taylor even more. I'd recommend anything what he says. Well,
Jared Taylor was born in Japan and grew up speaking Japanese, actually. And I was the only white child in my great.
Yeah, it's funny because I like to stalk him about what Japanese things he likes. He has said he did watch anime children shows, but I don't know which ones. And he's actually he supposedly, Edward Seidensticker wrote the introduction to that book of Jared, one of the Western, named Western academics. And I think Donald Keene had something good to say, and Jack Seward. All those trinity of the Boulder Boys, pretty much American academics who even started Asian studies in the first place. When I think Jared Taylor was on that side and he had a youthful career. And I think it's funny, he turned and made his career based on race relationships, and the publishing of American Renaissance was pretty much his finding of his identity. I think maybe Japan has something to do with his, I guess, coming out, where it's like, you know what? I'm not Japanese. Not to say I don't know Jared Taylor would actually say this, but I would like to know, certainly.
So with your music, can you kind of talk about how you got started and, how would you describe your genre? I mean, it's electronic music and, experimental noise music, but if you want to get technical, what would be the best way to describe it?
I was very interested in music when I was young, but it was really in the family, and because my older brother is more of the musician. And so at a very young age, I was exposed to music, but I really liked electronic music and stuff. I remember I was really young. I liked Mr. Scruff because it was cute, but, I really became the musician when my family forced me to play guitar, and, I kind of didn't like it, but I had to. But my first music and interest was when I was probably about 16 or 15, and I was a chiptune musician, and chiptunes were really big in the zeros. It was kind of this, you know, you had LSDJ and Nanoloop, and I had the name DJ Quado. I had a 7-inch and, you know, everything. And basically at that very young age of 16, I would play as opening acts in Philadelphia. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I thought that was my life. There's actually a live show you can probably find on Last.fm on DJ Quado, DJ Q-U-D-O. I did in 2010. And basically I had a Game Boy and I made some Game Boy music and I had about 107 inches and they all went out. It's somewhere obscure, probably around the area, but all my music's uploaded digitally online. This one
chip music on SoundCloud, a lot of it is like clips from like video games.
Yes, yes. That's what I like to get, the MIDI files of video games, and I still reference them of older. You might actually, there is that deep fascination with video games and stuff. I just wanted to say, there's this one Swedish guy named Foxy Decay, and he actually owns some of my music from my Killing 774 label, which was all the chiptune music I released when I was really young. And I think he has the rights over it, but he's been publishing it on his own label by Foxy Decay. I think you could, I have to find it somewhere. It's somewhere, even on the archive websites. It's very interesting. But when I got a little older, I was into like really weird experimental noise music online. And I like this one band called Rotten Noise, X Rotten X Noise X. And it was kind of more like a joke off Anal Cunt. And it really was just a knockoff that to extent of White House. And I thought White House was really cool when I was young. I didn't know what it was. I listened to similar jokey noise. I think there's a band called The Real Johnny Cash. He's from Texas. But kind of that silly crapcore news music. But the thing what really struck me when I was 17, I got into something called digital hardcore. And there was this band called Realicide and Mavis Concave. And they were kind of this band that would go around electronic gabber, hardcore punk music. And I was really into that when I was 17. I later became a really big fan of Atari Teenage Riot and KMFDM. You know, I actually wore KMFDM shirts to high school and everyone thought I was going to shoot up the school.
Yeah,
or
that's
something.
Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold were big into KMFDM.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love that. I think KMFDM still has that romantic identity within. I still flirt with it, even though I don't. They don't have Nash or Raymond Watts anymore. It's just Sasha and his wife, and it's okay. Well, there is some left wing theories to them, but it's just there is this hardcore, like, I hate society and amazing lyrics. I love all their stuff, but you know, it's funny because when I was young, seeing Realicide, you can actually find the Philadelphia clip from years back. And I was a very young self in a green t-shirt. I'm in several Realicide videos, actually. I was the Realicide groupie. I went to every Realicide show. And I thought that was better than punk music. I thought digital hardcore was the truth. I thought this Atari Teenage Riot ripoff band was the truth. But, you know, I outgrew that. And it's still relevant, though, digital hardcore. I mean, I recently saw 10Trix Point Never. He's often cited as, like, the very first vaporwave musician with his release of Eco Jams with the dolphin on it from 2010.
It's like Daniel Lopatin.
Wasn't it, like, the one called a C-Punk?
Yeah, yeah. And 10Trix Point Never, he's kind of often cited as the very first innovator of vaporwave. He was in Philadelphia, but his new stuff is pretty much digital hardcore. It's pretty much just like a new Atari Teenage Riot, but it's interesting. But yeah, it's funny because going on previously the topic, there were tons of white males, Asian females there. It was funny. It was basically the white boyfriends bought out of City Hawken to bring, or no, they brought their Chinese girlfriends over there and they watched this Guggenheim core show and they just said, oh, what a great show. And they I don't know, there's something about that. But I tried to start a digital hardcore band when I was young. I called it My Melody. It was about a cartoon show called My Life as a Teenage Robot, which I really love the aesthetic style too. And it was this kind of gabber scream. I have tapes of it. Some of it's online, I'm not so sure, but I have to go dig in my old files. You could definitely find some, I guess, shitcore bands I was in called Zombies on Skyscrapers and Depth's Obituary. You can find it on YouTube. Those were bands basically deliberately bad. I did that with some friends, and it was interesting, but kind of getting out of music and who cares, you know. Maybe something like Red Pilot's Son would do.
is all your stuff on SoundCloud? Is that your more recent stuff?
All my recent stuff from the past 2 years, Pizza Dog Studios, PSO119, and Kinktrode is in the past 2 years. That's all my recent stuff. And I basically started making music when I got out of Asian studies, and I basically got home and I said, I got to go back into music. And so when I got back into music, the first thing I bought was like a Korg MS-20 MIDI. And I just tried to put that out MIDI and just get video game songs and just kind of mess with that. I did Mario Kart 64 themes and, old video games. I actually had a video synthesizer by Taichon. And on my Pizza Dog Studios YouTube, you can watch some of the videos for that. And I basically messed with like the Brave Little Toaster and the Hobbit and just made like Smog the Dragon and Pizza City 2070.
Funny. That's like one of the very first movies I remember seeing in theaters.
Yeah, I just made this.
When did that come out? I forget.
88? 89?
That makes sense.
But it was I just messed with that. I just put some beats to it, and it's on the Pizza Dog Studio website. I also took a video of my bedroom a few years ago at my family's house, and there was my studio then. It's different then. I was just joking around for pizza. There was a website for www.pizzadogstudios.com, but it got taken down because I didn't feel like paying the bill, and I think I'd done enough with it. I felt like I was going to re-put up the website, which I will. On that website, I just put up Gangro porn and just some Asian porn there and just some shock art stuff and some funny YTMD joke references and like
a little. Well, this is more like on our past show, a little off topic, but like, what's your favorite genre of Asian porn?
Well, I like all porn, you believe it or not. I think porn is really interesting, but it's funny that in Asian pornography, there's this kind of, I call it gangro or kind of beauty girl, which is kind of the translation, gyaru. It's this kind of fashion where, these Japanese girls, mostly prostitutes, they dress up in black skin and they have blonde hairs and they have the etiquettes of white girls. But they're often porn actresses and prostitutes, and they're under the age of like 25, and they actually go and hunt down white men. I've seen them before. They're very rare, and you have to be in Japan to see this. And some of the porn on these websites are actually dark-skinned, blonde-haired Japanese girls trying to act American or something.
They don't get interesting because, like, in Asian cultures, the ideal of beauty is like that porcelain white skin, and they're kind of rebelling against that, and
they're this kind of cosmopolitan. That's what they think American is. They think they want the skin of a black woman, the blonde hair of a white girl, and the etiquette of Asian girl. And so it's like, but they want white cock, or they want some kind of white penis, but they get Asian penis in return. There's some gangro porn online which they go with blacks, which I think is funny. And there is some kind of subtle hip hop rap acceptance of that, but thinking black culture is this some kind of, but it's often frowned upon in Japanese culture. But at the same time, it's the main, like, it's street culture. It's real. I have a couple of books on gangro culture. It's funny. Ask any Asian studies student or anyone about this, and they get shocked and they think it's racist. Well, it's actually quite different. Well, it would represent the multicultural.
One of our guests, Daryl Hamamoto, he actually directed his own porn.
I was willing to. I wanted to see that, but I don't. It's on my list, but I didn't see it yet. I should see it. I actually have collections of some porn, and I actually am somewhat of the porn collector. I have favorite actresses. I think I really like who are they? Like Aiki Kurosawa and Mana Azumi. They're kind of the gangaroos. They'll dress up in like black, dark skin, have really long fingernails, blonde hair. I think Kurosawa was wearing a t-shirt sucking
toothpicks. I don't really.
And she said, hip hop is like, not dead.
When I think of like Japanese porn, I think more of like the schoolgirl outfits.
Yeah, I mean, that's really popular among, average, oh, I want Japanese, but hey, it's also really popular in Japan for Japanese to act black or some kind of American white girl or some super hybrid. This might have something to do with Asianarianism. I'm not so sure, but it's this strange, it's definitely, I think there is eroticism with dark skin. Erotic, dark skin is definitely very erotic. Kurosawa, you know, sucking two dicks wearing a t-shirt saying, hey guys, hip hop is not dead. What's that supposed to mean? Is like she listens to like hip hop or some kind of rap of by Designer or something like that? I don't know. I'm curious, the music. But I have an interest that they listen to Eurobeat. And I really love Eurobeat music. I'll probably go off the topic of this, but Eurobeat was probably the music I fell in love with when I was like 19. I think I found the ultimate form of dance music that was just – I mean, I was into house.
What would you say was like the peak of a Eurobeat, the 90s or early 2000s? Because I remember
– Yeah, remember what?
I remember living – I mean, you don't hear it as much in the United States, but I lived in England in 2002 when I was 16, and they played that kind of music nonstop.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Eurobeat is just
– Like I guess a good example of that, they had something like – I forget the name. There's this song that was like a pop, like a kind of a pop version of Bryan Adams' song Heaven. They were playing that song nonstop.
Yes, that's DJ Sammy.
Okay, yeah, that's that Eurobeat.
Well, no, that's kind of yeah. Well, there's Eurodance, which is like Aqua and Toy Box. You know, I am a Barbie girl, and you know, that's there's that bubblegum Eurodance. That's in yeah, that was definitely in the 90s, but. Eurobeato is this kind of was made up by the Japanese. It's more a offshoot of Italo disco. I strongly looking up the Wikipedia page. Eurobeat is kind of this. It took off from Italo. Italo is a very it's about 5 minutes long, and it comes with an opening, but it's known for its main chorus riffs. It's but Eurobeat was big in the 90s. It was but more in Japan and some obscure. I would actually say some of the Brazilian clubs really like Eurobeat. The Brazilians are very fascinated with Eurobeat, where I read from. But the name was coined by the Japanese to refer to white Italian people making electronica Enka music for them, I would say. I'm not so sure if Enka is the right word. It's kind of silly.
Disco, Italo was more the 80s. Like,
yeah.
American, it was something very obscure for Americans. Like a good example of that would be like this song Tarzan Boy by Baltimora.
Yes, and basically, yeah, that's a great example. That's like
and the also Chatelet by Pepe. Alex, you want
to
play that?
Oh, sure. I just want to say, to interject, not to rain on the – I'm like the parade rainer today. I'm like pretty anti-porn. You guys think porn is good? I think it's bad. It's okay if you like it. I'm not – you know, to each their own, but
– I mean, whatchamacallit? I mean – not to get in my sex life here, but my one Chinese girlfriend, she was kind of the eccentric, and she liked BDSM. And one time, we were kind of first time doing it sex, and she wanted me to tie her to her bed. Or no, it didn't happen like that. But she basically, she bit my penis, and it hurted. And I didn't like it. And I was like, you know what? And I didn't climax. I didn't ejaculate. I was like, this is too, maybe ejaculate her back. But the thing was, she was just really kinky into that. I think that was probably one of our relationship breakers, is that she called herself a sadist without a reason, and yet she liked it because she was into that, and I don't know why. we just had really wacky sex, but it was just too wacky.
What is that? How does that bring you into porn, though? Because I think like having sex is different. It obviously, it's different from viewing porn. I think that porn is like like an opiate or something.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand. And but why I study it is because there is this lasting influence on porn on millennials, and there's definitely no denial about that. And I think, okay, well, it must mean porn has a better cultural influence, metapolitical influence, than our TV does. And we might know some certain porn actresses that are popular. And then you have to ask, what are their lives like? You know, this will bring in the whole cultural anthropology thing. What are their lives like? And what do they do? How are they? You know, and you kind of – it's interesting to think about that someone is filming getting their dick sucked, which is interesting in a way. but it's also an experience, as if we want to role play in that. If that, that's my penis.
So are you talking about like amateur pornography? When you're saying
You might find these on like X videos or XNXX, you know, some of those dirty.
What's street with websites. All those weird Japanese fetishes? Like one of them is like, have you heard of a Gokun?
I think I know what that is. Remind me again. I think I. What is that?
It's when a woman drinks a bunch of
That's my thought. I was thinking, isn't that when she's drinking? Okay, that's interesting. It's kind of. I don't mean that. I'm going to make my assumption and say it's kind of collective and nationalist. I mean, there's a whatchamacallit. There was that one feminist thigh girl who did a film with Ron Jeremy where she would be the hugest, biggest bukkake ever. Peter Sotos wrote about that. I think he wrote an interview, but she basically was ejaculated on like over 200 men. And then after, she was never heard again, but she was on the Jerry Springer Show. I can't recall her name. This was recent. I was learning about this.
Did that whole thing have its origins in Japan?
No, she wasn't Japanese. She was an Asian American. And
no, the act itself.
Oh, the with the glass. Whatchamacallit. You know, it's funny. I was thinking of another film. It's because largest indoor sex orgy ever. And so just like a room of 100 Japanese and 100 Japanese females just doing it. In a room having sex. I think this is obviously a huge view on. But with the whole glass thing, they kind of look at the whore as a whore, right? The whore has the responsibility of pleasuring all the men. So she has to drink all their sperm, and all the sperm has to go in her body. And she has to kind of incubate that sperm to create this one kind of power domination thing. But in a way, I think if you think about it, it creates one mega Space Odyssey baby or something. Oh, that's my humor, but I don't know. But yeah, there's a lot of things, and even bukkake itself is everyone takes turns jerking off on a girl. In fact, it's true that I read this one Japanese porn actress. She likes doing it. I gotta find her article again. She liked doing it is because she had relationships with each of the guys, and everyone who jerked off her, she can say, oh, you were the nice guy I had tea with. Thanks. So that's another way to think about. Or sometimes, like, I don't know you, but it's strange. It definitely has to be talked about. And there definitely is this weird racial collectiveness in porn in Japan.
Alex, do you want to play Shadowy now?
Okay.
Chatelet by a band called Pepe, and this what's interesting is this song came out in the 80s by this disco Italo band. Their name is actually Pepe, and they have like a frog on their album cover, and this became like this big online sensation.
I think that's funny because I thought it was made in 2016, and I didn't realize that this was coincidental.
It was like a parody when I first saw it, but then later I found out it was like 30 years old.
Super coincidental with a Pepe and a frog. How magical is that? I don't know.
I found like an English interpretation of the lyrics, and they're like very like esoteric.
the whole Keck thing with the esoteric. I don't know. How that works, though. I mean, I just know about these things, but I don't really look into it. I mean, interesting, though. Yeah.
I was listening to some podcast, I forget the guy's name, but he was saying, like, all these, like, how, like, Pepe and Keck had their origins and, like, occultism.
That was
Styx
Hexenhammer. That was Styx Hexenhammer.
Oh, yeah.
We really need to get him on this show. Love that guy.
Oh, whatchamacallit. Yeah, for internet memes, I used to really like him on YTMND. I think I liked the first meme I ever liked was Cat on a Synthesizer in Space. This was an old YTMND meme.
Oh, that's really old.
Yeah, that was like YTMD. I think I know all the YTMD fads. There was this one YTMD fad from the Spider-Man 2 movie, and he goes, "He stole that guy's pizza." And it's basically this black guy going around saying, "Pizza." And he writes in this weird
Oh, what about this one? What about this one? "Snooping as usual, I see. Pingas."
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The Pingas. The Pingas. I remember Pingas for some bit, and it was online for a bit. But yeah, I know all those funny YTMDs, like "Nigga stole my bike," and yeah, I had my own fads. I was the whole, "Oh yeah, Mr. Crab fad guy," and I basically, what I did was I cut off a head of Mr. Crab's, I posted on pictures, and it goes, "Oh yeah, Mr. Crab," and it's just this blaring screaming, and I just had
that. Did you ever get into a Pepe?
No, I was just, you know, it's funny, I think the rare Pepes being sold on eBay is interesting, and I was tempted to buy them sometimes to see if I really did get rare Pepes, and so I can talk to my friends, and hey, I got these actual rare Pepes, like trading cards, but yeah, maybe if he was cuter, I don't know, maybe I like new Pepe, maybe I like the angry Pepe too, maybe I was more of the
feel. I like the angry one, and I also like the smug one.
Yeah, and there's the poopy Pepe and the whole and there's I like the feels guy. He's looking sad.
Yeah.
Wojak.
Did you see that song reminded you of a lot of disco Italo songs you've heard before?
Yes. You know, it's funny because Italo has this very straightforward beat, like you said about, you know, Baltimora and Tarzan Boy. But I'm thinking of records like by Brian Ice, like Talking to the Night, or any record by Eddie Huntington, such like Up and Down. Some of those Italo disco records, thinking of another one, Llama, Love is on the Rocks. They're kind of at this beat with like the drum comes in, synthesizer, the lead. Oh, there's this great song I was listening to, Swan, Shining Star. I could just list them all over and over. I have some Italo disco collection on MP3s. I have some vinyl, but not that much. It's really a rare genre. But Eurobeat was basically the sped up kind of rave version of Italo, but more targeting towards the Japanese. And definitely there's this vaporwave aestheticism about Italo, because it's old, it's the 80s, they use drum machines and synthesizer. Rise them some Donald Trump Oreo Pizza Hut commercial from whatever. And, you know, it's easy to get into that, like, genre of music. And so, you know, as for Eurobeat goes, I'm like, ideal Eurobeat records, I would say, is, I'll give some titles, FCF Bad Desire, or King and Queen by King and Queen, Big Brother, Wild Reputation. These are kind of records which they have this lead called Asabi, which is kind of like you sing along to it, or it's just this weird, wacky synth line, particularly from, I would say, a Nord lead synthesizer or something from a preset. But it's just this wacky, like, and it goes from really different, you know, beats per minute. Some of the older 90s ones get really fast, or like, especially by Virginelle. I'm thinking of the song Hot Love and Emotion, Kiss Me, Baby. Any song by Dave Rogers. But it's funny to note, YTMND was in love with this one Eurobeat song by Max Cavouri, which is Brat Sinclair and Dijo. And that song was called Running in the 90s. And basically it showed the Ronald McDonald guy pointing forward and it said, "Running in the 90s, lol," or something. And it said, da-na, da-na, da-na. It was also in the anime Initial D. Initial D had a lot of songs by Brat Sinclair and Dijo. And these were just like really fast Eurobeat songs. And when people still listen to Eurobeat, especially in the Western world, they'll often refer to Initial D funny and not really dance music. I'm also thinking about other songs like DSX, Boom Boom Fire, and Burning Love, Night of Fire. There's this kind of theme in songs about fire and dancing and reoccurring lyrics. The para para is the dance they do to Eurobeat. And like I said before, Gangaro and Gurau culture, you know, fashion, these black skin prostitutes will hang out in these clubs. I mean, I never experienced it. It's kind of just in my mind and fiction, but I hear about it. And from what I've read from this one Gangaro book I have, is that these dark-skinned, blonde-haired, lightly clad, hot prostitute women hang out in a dance clubs of Italo disco and vaporwave s, and it's like, wow, I want to be a part of that scene and have good sex with these girls. And it's just you kind of fall in love with that aesthetic. And so there's this interesting fantasy world about Eurobeat and about this thing, which is, it should be revealed in the West or something, but it's not really talked about. And so it's just really fringe. And I think it's a really interesting music. I don't know how to make it, because really, really talented Italian people make it. And so there's this kind of white nationalist edge to it. It's not really Asian as we prefer. It's Asian manufactured by whites and them liking us. And so it really could fall under. So when somebody on the right says, think about all the great music, right? Like Richard Wagner, right? Just say, well, what about Eurobeat? That's a great dance music made by white people. And so it's an interesting music, and I love Eurobeat. I listen to it all the time, and Italo disco. But yeah, it's something that makes me happy every time I hear it. It'll be like a boost of a drug. It's interesting. I could just.
What do you think about like a synth wave and like the new retro wave that it became popular like in the early 2010s, but it kind of was inspired by like 80s music?
Yeah, like Neon Indian and the guys that came. You know, when that came up, I thought it was interesting.
Let's see, there's like there's College Electric Youth.
Yeah.
There's FM Attack.
I remember. Yep. Oh yeah, I love FM. I love FM Attack because you played it on your show, and now I can't stop listening to Runaway.
Yeah, I only know that band from Robert Stark.
Yeah. It's funny.
It's like Robert Stark music, you know.
And yeah, that's why it makes me happy. Yeah, I remember listening to College. I thought it was cool because I was like, wow, it sounds like an old record. I was like a young kid at 16 at that time. And
that music, it always has this like build up. It doesn't like a generic pop song goes right to the chorus.
I'm thinking of
kind of a gradual build up with the synth and it starts off and then it builds up and then it isn't until like 1 minute in. And
yeah.
Then you hear the like vocals.
Yeah, it's funny. It has that Italia riff to it. I'm thinking of the song. I think the band's called Lifelike. And the album's called So Electric. That was kind of popular during the time. I'm thinking of that as being that genre you're calling from. You know, at that time, I thought it was cool, the music, but I thought it was too nostalgic. When I was really young, I liked Daft Punk. Probably because they were in that anime band by Lenji Matsumoto, Interstellar 555. You know, it was that band. That's kind of the secret reason why everybody likes Daft Punk, is because it's a virtual anime band. And their music goes perfectly with that. And so Daft Punk was into filter. They call it French house. You basically get a disco sample and go, and just the filter that, you know, that builds up. They used the Korg MS-20.
Music has actually been like featured in like a lot of Hollywood movies. Like the most famous one, like the one Doing It Right.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's Thomas Bang Alter and some of his records, even anything on Roulette Records. They call it French house. I just call it filter. That was the music I loved. And when this Neon Indian stuff came out, I'm like, they just got a synthesizer and they're trying to act on Daft Punk's filter method. And that's what I thought in some funny respect. But I always think that in some respect, vaporwave, if you get an old record by some commercial, slow it down to such zero, add a little filter, you know, and then your Macintosh Plus, right?
But vaporwave doesn't have the same like a catchiness is like the new retro wave does.
It's more like avant-garde noise where anybody can do it. And it's funny, like weather music for, there's this vaporwave documentary online my brother showed me.
Oh yeah, I've seen it.
And there's that one album where it says, well, it's actually a Weather Channel music and pretends you found it for a Weather Channel that doesn't exist. There's some creepy pasta nature to it where it's like this fictional Slender Man. And I think, I don't know why. That has that background to it. But I think it's funny, but I always loved, you know, it's funny, people like listening to old music when you can just listen to old music. And going off a bit, you know, I think I really liked the first form of music I really took seriously was Chicago house music. I really liked Frankie Knuckles and everything on Trax Records. I loved, you know, acid house with Future. I was so interested that I thought, you know, culture anthropology, this black community in Chicago, just takes these machines used for making crappy retroactive rock music in the 80s. They took it and they made this weird, blatantly post-disco, bizarre black industrial music coming from Chicago. And I always thought, wow, that music needs to be recreated. But it's been done so much time that no white listener can stand it anymore. It's kind of autistic and hobbyist, especially this acid house music.
What do you think of like a vaporwave as like a visual aesthetic, like in like the illustrations, but we've also talked about like in architecture even?
You know, it's funny. I have a friend and he has to watch artsy music YouTube so he can feel good about himself or something. And what artsy music does is they get these obscure 80s, 70s animes not known in the white Western world and just put on some filter tracks or some vaporwave as if you're living the experience of that said anime. There's this strange kind of, oh, I wish I was an anime character, and there's that aesthetics of it. Definitely in vaporwave, there's this nostalgia of coming back to a future William Gibson Neuromancer Japan. I do believe in Aiduru by Gibson. The first chapter he brings out with girls hanging out with each other, and they all have interchangeable manga eyes and blue hair and green hair, as if why would white girls want to don that? And I think it's true. You know, I've been trying to elaborate this theory on Asian Aryanism, and I really think it happens in kid shows. And you know what? It's like if you look at these West Coast cartoon shows like Star versus the Force of Evil, you know, Bee and Puppy Cat, and maybe the older show like My Life as a Teenage Robot, it kind of flirts with this Japanese people and aesthetic and art style. The same could go reversed in Western theory in Japanese animes like Candy Candy, you know, Anne of Green Gables, even the recent Miyazaki film, The Wind Rises, even though I think that's a completely far-right film. I don't even know why that was pushed to begin with. But the ideal that in Japan, they love this kind of white people aesthetic and they put it in their films. But in America, we just like multiculturalism. We take our favorite sushi, our favorite stuff black people make, and then white people appropriate it. And they make these shows like Cuckoo Harajuku by Gwen Stefani. And it has nothing to do with the basis of Japanese basis. Or basically, I was thinking
Didn't she do some song that was like an 80s influence a while back?
I think so. Well, she did
she
do
covered
a Talk
Talk. Talk Talk, yeah.
I love Talk Talk, by
great.
The way.
I mean, Talk Talk's great. Yeah, that's...
I love Talk Talk. I love Spirit of Eden.
I mean, Mark Hollis is a really interesting guy. He seems to have really, he was very political, and he seems to have, like, disavowed life or something, you know.
Going on hard, yeah, it's funny because Pitchfork and some of the outlet media think he's come kind of hermit that of J.D. Salinger, and he's basically, he doesn't want all the fame, he just wants, but I think he just wants to live a good, honest life.
Well, that's, I feel that way about Paddy McAloon from Prefab Sprout. Even though he has an ear problem that makes him I think he has a lot of physical problems, but you know,
yeah,
I respect artists like that. You know, I'd made music when I was younger and eventually just sort of stopped, and I think that it's good to stop things sometimes. And you know, I mean, I understand like going forward with a tradition, but I also think that like, you know, you can make art and then just live your life as well.
Oh yeah, and I think that's what Hollis has been pretty much doing after is, you know, and then when he releases an album, it's all big, oh, here comes, he's back from the grave, he's making, and it's like, how are you sure he'll make a new album? I mean, it's just people are in love with his.
What's interesting is with like the vaporwave illustrations, there's the ones that use a lot of like kind of light colors, like a lot of pink and magentas, and there's those illustrations that are like kind of the 80s retrofuturism, like, but more like dark, like a lot of, they're very like night, these nighttime scenes with like a lot of neon.
Yeah, that's funny, like you're always at night, you know. It's, I know, when I think about that, I think of Akira. It's well loved everywhere in any independent theater. Somehow there's this Western fascination with the anime film Akira. Is because they love looking at this hugely expensive anime that's kind of avant-garde and, you know, kind of artsy. And at the same time, especially in the open scene, when Kaneda is riding down the hill against the Joker gang, he sees all these, like, neon lights. And you might see this again with Vaporwave acts pretending in their GIF files and YouTube videos. There is that interesting aesthetic, and it once again shows you this future Japan that was flirted in the mid-80s.
And yeah, it really does have that kind of aesthetic that you see in a lot of those. I know I've seen some new retro-wave videos based on the film, and you definitely see the influence on things like cyberpunk and vaporwave. We don't really have time to get into like the plot of the film, but can you kind of describe like the aesthetics of it?
Yeah, you know, Akira is really interesting on its own. You know, the comic and the movie are very different, but you know, it's always played at the local movie theater in Philadelphia, and it's kind of has its cult following to it. You know, the first time I saw Akira when I was like 15, but I often, you know, refer to the movie as the motorcycles as like Tron bicycles. I think I first heard about Akira was through like an interview with the rapper Del the Funky Homo Sapien, and he liked Akira for some reason. So basically a rapper endorsed me into Akira. But I think a few years ago when I was 18, you know, when it was my freshman year, I was into movies, and in the college theater, they were playing Akira at 9 o'clock, and I was like one of the only people in the theater. And it just left a good impression on me, and I think, wow, it's actually quite a fantastic movie. And often I had some Asian studies classes. I would reference Akira in my homework as this kind of, everyone knows about it, so there it is. I mean, Akira for the aesthetic pleasure, you know, it plays on the Neuromancer joke that, like, Japan is going to rule the world. But, you know, ironically in the film, you know, Japan is the lowest of low. They lost World War III, and it's like this exploded pole or something.
Yeah, it's apocalyptic. Like, it also reminds me a little bit of, like, a Blade Runner.
Yeah. It's funny, the more irony is that, like, the film, it takes place in the year 2020, which is about a few, you know, years away. But
I think Blade Runner also takes place around that time,
2018, yeah.
It's funny because the Japanese Olympics is supposed to happen in 2020, but in Akira, the Japanese Olympics also happens in the year 2020, and the remains of Akira are hidden under the Olympic Stadium, the 2020 Olympic Stadium, so you might actually see some real Akira happening in a few years. But I don't know, I think that's... But there's that interesting pleasure to it. I mean, the Western audiences really love Akira because there's also a deep message behind it, which is rarely elaborated on. And, you know, people elaborate that, you know, Tetsuo is the main character. It's less about Kaneda. It's interesting to think about that, but I think what the Western audience really likes that kind of violence or that kind of grotesque, like, you know, Norwestern will go and say to the film, whoa, this is Japanese. It looks really violent. It's not a kid's cartoon, is it? And so, you know, especially when Tetsuo malforms this giant monster later on in the film.
Do you see the aesthetics of Akira as, like, a model for, like, your Asian-Aryanism utopia?
Not really. I just think it's a kind of a kitsch kind of movie from the 1980s. It is a very interesting... It's actually a dystopian. So, because it's a dystopian film, I don't advocate living the Neuromancer dystopian lifestyle, since it's kind of a sad place to live in. I would think more of the... Asian-Aryan lifestyle. This might be a little off-topic, but before then, like we were referencing before then, Legend of Zelda and Legend of Zelda, especially the Wind Waker. You might see like a lot of white Americans loving that, like anything by Nintendo. So basically, the art behind the character Toon Link has some kind of Asian-Aryanism to them. I was just actually researching about it a bit. I have to elaborate more on an article to write about it, but it's this weird blonde-haired, white, but Japanese-eyed character that supposedly whites will gravitate towards, where you can have the Tolkien universe, but then there's this Japanese pleasure aesthetics. That's what I really mean to go by Asian-Aryanism. It's kind of this own thing. I have to elaborate. I know there's this role-playing in cyberpunk. Yes, I guess there is some love for that, but I guess I'm more speaking as to this organic white Asian thing that will eventually happen. There's a future, right?
It is something really beautiful at the same time. Like,
the first intro when they're on the bikes and they show the holograms, that very first thing when they're against the Joker gang and his gang, and then they're just fighting it out until it dwells into more of the plot. That is interesting to some respect. I mean, some of the manga is also very gritty and dark. It's more like Warhammer 40K gritty and darkness. But yeah, it's that ideal that you want to roleplay as this Japanese character. I can understand that bit. I mean, going back on William Gibson, his novel Eidoru, you know, he clearly says in the first chapter, girls will have different color hairs, they'll get to design their manga eyes, and they're all basically whites pretending they're Japanese. I think, yeah, that is the subtle Asian Aryanism in it. I think that is really interesting.
A lot of people have been to Japan, and they've actually said Japan and even Hong Kong, those cities felt more futuristic in the 80s than they do today in some ways.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I'm always concerned about this. I really think Tokyo is white people's favorite non-white place because it's so white. And so they can basically take it to their advantage and put things and be like, oh, I could take your food and video games. You don't mind. And they don't mind either because of politics and weather. But I always think it's funny when Aphex Twin had his new album, Cheetah, they put it all over I forget what part of Tokyo, but on a big screen. Above your, like, okay, that's the future, Aphex Twin's Cheetah album. Is the Japanese really going to, you know, it's something that seems so white, and at the same time, it's like, it's there, and it kind of represents the, I think it's interesting, but I at the same time, it's like, the play, you're role-playing as, this is the future. And I, once again, I think that has something to do with Asian Aryanism.
What do you think about, like, implementing a lot of those aesthetics, like, vaporwave into like actual architecture?
Once again, I think it really has to do with, you know, like Neuromancer and this obsession, this obsession with Japan into the Western world. And so what they're really trying to do is we're really trying to reinvent Western civilization in an age where you can't be, you know, you have to be politically correct. You have to be anti-white. You have to, so white people can only put their interests if they were non-white. The best people to do it are like the Japanese, and so, or Asian. And so they're going to put that and biasly choose the Japanese and say, well, we can pretend we're white people acting as Japanese and do that in aesthetic wise. You know, my favorite aesthetic wise for anything is an obscure anime from 82. It's called Patario. And it's literally one of my favorite animes ever. It was also a manga from late 70s, and it's, the anime was in the early 80s, kind of on the 70s side. It flirts with many things. Like, there's right-wing imagery in it with swastikas, fascist dictators, Patalio being this gay little kid with diabetes. You know, there's some homosexuality and pedophilia in it. It has this interesting Art Nouveau style by the artist Mino Maya. It's an all-men kind of girl world. It's basically like James O'Mara's work, but in the form of anime. It's also like this Asian Aryanism where they're half white and half Japanese, and America really doesn't exist unless they speak Japanese. And speaking on why it's not well known, there's this Japanese manga academic named Fred Schaut. He wrote a book called Manga Manga. But I think it was in his second book that he wrote that Patalio is the first yaoi anime ever of boy love or man to boy love. However, it has very controversial themes of pedophilia. Yet at the same time, doing some, you know, research, you know, the Patalio was really quite popular in the 80s. They were in American fanzines and people were really interested with. I love the aesthetics of Bankura and Mary Arc. In fact, I actually follow the fan dub of Patalio being made right now. I was trying to get in contact with the translator, Emiral, I had to go over and say thank you for translating this work. I mean, I found it. I was interested in what it is. And, you know, even the artist himself who made Patalio, Maya, he's a cross-dresser. He's a ballerina. He's an esoteric tarot card reader. There's so much of the stuff that needs to be put in English. It's just not there. And his art is currently like Beardsley or like the Irish painter Harry Clark. And there's this Lovecraft style too. Even his other arts, other than Patalio, like Astra Tarot, is like this tarot wielding kind of homosexual guy who goes in these Lovecraft universes. Oh, I just love his art. I try to mimic it all the time. And so I always think that there's that aesthetic to live by. You know, with the whole vaporwave, people want to either live the aesthetic of Akira. I like the aesthetic of Pataleo, and I always wish there was some kind of artsy music Pataleo, but the West kind of doesn't know about it. And that's why hence
think about the aesthetic of the film Mishima, Life in Four Chapters by Schrader.
You know what? I've actually did not see that start to finish. Okay. Which is funny, but I've seen the last one. It's on YouTube.
You really need to watch it.
I know. It's funny because it's so funny because I read like six Mishima books, and then obviously I don't have time to watch a Mishima film. I did watch, there's this one classical Mishima documentary right after his death that features Donald Keen and Harry Stokes, who wrote Mishima's biography. That is a really good, and that was like the only film of Mishima, and that contains Mishima speaking English.
Have you seen the film Patriotism?
Yes. That's
a film that Mishima directed himself, Robert. It's a half an hour long, really, really interesting.
Pilater, you told me that you were interested in studying like urban planning in college.
You know, it's funny because I learned about it through your show about how there's Grow San Francisco, and it was that's interesting. I mean, I don't have plans to move to San Francisco, but I think that's funny that they're trying to lower the cost.
Definitely the most like Asian major American city, except for maybe Honolulu.
Yeah, I know, because it's right next to Japan, obviously. But, you know, here on the East Coast, especially in the major city, it's all Chinese. And I don't know, it's just your preference. I mean, I always watch what, you know, I'm not a Japanophile in some sense, yet it is kind of an interest. At the same time, I do like the Chinese a lot. And I always think there needs to be respect for Chinese. But at the same time, we hardly know any really things about Chinese because their government is so Confucius, whatever, you know, tensions we have with them. They're very militant people. And it just shows you, on average, white society is going to clash with Chinese society. And so Japanese society is going to be more submissive, and we're going to be in open arms with them rather than, you know, China, especially Korea.
Well, you know, but earlier on in the show, you said that the Chinese were more open than the Japanese.
Yeah, definitely.
You think on a state level?
It's ironic.
No, I know what you're saying. I should have said that, you know, because of World War II and because of some things and some self-defeatism, we, you know, got in there and basically through force became open arms is because the culture war, and they thought they could be more culture. The Chinese, I should be more very specific on my terms. The Chinese are the ones that, you know, they have run the whole market and, you know, run cheap, the Chinese. And it's part of the Chinese strategy to send their girls out to different countries, have sex with foreign men. It doesn't come out a race mixed child, it comes out Chinese. And so,
well, it's also a more effective strategy. I mean, I even heard there were, because it's an effective strategy. Like, if you look at the strategy of like the migrant invasion of Europe, is to go into Europe and try to steal as many European women as possible. That's going to lead to a major, eventually, like a violent backlash. But the Chinese strategy is a much more effective strategy.
Yeah, I think they have nothing to lose on it when whites are kind of actually afraid to race mix. I mean, during the time of Alexander the Great, the Hellenistic period, that's all we would pretty much do. The Greeks would just, Alexander the Great goes to Egypt and Greek societies would fall in love with the beautiful Egyptian women. What comes out? Greek. And that was kind of the strategy during that Hellenistic period, but it didn't really turn out that way. You know, and it seems to me that whites have been more, I don't know, on the white nationalist side of things, you're a race trader, race mixer, if you got things, but on the Chinese, you know, it's just for class. There's already too many abundance of Chinese to begin with, you know.
So earlier I touched upon the topic of implementing a vaporwave into urban design, but the kind of a question is, like, how do you define what is vaporwave?
What is vaporwave? And you have to define vaporwave. Is it just being around Japanese culture, and then it's vaporwave. You know, if you go in Japan,
be explicitly Japanese, but there's a certain like color pattern.
You know, there has to be like a vaporwave institution. They have to say, all right, is it Western or is it Japanese or is it all, you know, I don't know. Someone has to make there's the vaporwave
like
national.
Vaporwave is multicultural because you have like the Roman bust mixed
oh,
in.
Oh, yeah. I always think that's ironically secret white nationalist alt-right, you know. Yeah. I always think it's funny. Like, Identity Europa is playing, flirting with that, with like Roman bust and like, you know, some of those videos online with the whole synthwave thing, and they're trying to be like clean cut.
There's all these alt-right synthwave artists now, like X-Curious and Cyber Nazi.
Yeah, I think it's funny because to me, all you have to do is make a normal song and then make it alt-right. It's like if I got my Roland TR-909 and TB-303 and I made a song called Gas the Kikes, and then and you can't tell it from a Josh Winks song or some Acid House song. So I feel like, you know, so as long, I think it gets, we're living in a tag world where SoundCloud is basically a bunch of tags, and you look for, oh, I'm going to make porncore. I know this really weird kid. I got to find his name. He's this Italian kid, and he makes noise music like Mirzbo, but he talks about hangtai and Japanese stuff, and he tries to be shock rock and like White House, but it doesn't really work well. I have to find his name again. I'm just thinking of that, but thinking about aesthetic wise, I always think music has a lot to do with aesthetics too. I always think there's this some kind of strange that when you listen to music, you kind of have to visualize places in your head. Like if you listen to vaporwave, you have to make a listen to vaporwave archetype. So I always think that's interesting to begin with. Like, does each music genre have its own? If you listen to like death metal, is it New Orleans? I don't know.
No.
Okay.
What is new retro wave has those as those like illustrations?
Yeah, because the music I'm listening to right now, I like Sandy and the Sunsets and Yukihiro Takahashi of Yellow Music Orchestra.
Oh, there's another one called like Dark Wave, which is big in Germany. There's like Project Pitchfork and like Dunkelwerk, which is very apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I've seen that before, but I'm not familiar.
Are you familiar with like a C-punk, like a Unicorn Kid?
It's funny. I know what Unicorn Kid is. I've listened to some tracks, but I think C-punk is funny because it jokes as this kind of creepypasta that there's this dolphin and you know, the dolphin has a story or something, or it's basically like that Eco the Dolphin fan club thing, and something to do with 10 Tricks Point Never and his first release. That's all I always think it has something to do, or at least some cheesy, like taking something seriously, but it's actually an internet fad. Like people literally take C-punk too legit and say this is C-punk fashion, and you basically get print all over me clothes, you dye your hair blue. You talk about old Genesis games. I don't know. Like, it's a culture.
Inspired, Sonic the Hedgehog and...
Uh-huh. And then sooner or later, they'll have their own C-punk music and C-punk, interesting. Like, when I'm talking about my own Asian Aryanism theory, I try to put in music I like.
Could you make the case for like video games for your theory for like video games like Zelda?
Yeah, you know it's funny.
I played the Zelda series on Super Nintendo as a kid, and it's interesting. It kind of combines like a Japanese and like medieval European aesthetics.
Yeah, you know it's funny. I, you know, traveling along Philadelphia, there's a Philadelphia College Orchestra, and there's this huge billboard, and it says, now playing the soundtrack to Legend of Zelda.
Really?
I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is a bunch of white 20-something-year-olds playing, oh my god, I'm going to play Legend of Zelda. And they're loving this speechless, blonde-haired Japanese kid that lives in this Tolkien-esque world that I never was into Zelda, but I thought that it was cuckolded ideology. Because it's not really a white person. It's a white person presented by the Japanese, because the Japanese are unapologetically allowed to talk about white identity, and we're not. And so we get to go, they can say it, and we can love it, and but at the same time say it's diverse and multicultural. But I could definitely see the Asian-arism as a part that whites will definitely lean and say, I want to be an anime character. That's definitely a part of the Asian-arian theorism. Saying, denying your white, suburban, boring, public school, Nebraskan life, and then saying, I'm an anime character, or some eccentric, kooky, life's an anime, or something really strange. But I'm more into the interest of this hybrid of white and Japanese identity. I mean, there's this old folk band from the 70s called Betsy and Chris. They're these Hawaiian singers. They sang in fluent Japanese, but they're white. So it's really confusing to the eye. I have to find them again. But I always think that's interesting because what do the Japanese like, this Occidental interest? Or do we like singing folk songs in Japanese? That's really interesting to think about. Yeah, the band was Betsy and Chris. Betsy and Chris is basically, they look like some alt-left gig, but they were targeted towards the Japanese. They're American, but they speak fluently Japanese, and they just sing folk songs. I always think there's some kind of strange aesthetic to that. I always think Rabbit's alt-left theory, the band that reminds him of his architect and stuff is Stereolab. I don't know if Rabbit's a fan of Stereolab.
Oh, I think he's probably into Stereolab. I mean, and I guess, yeah, he kind of comes, he actually, in my mind, he reminds me of, like, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, the one where it's, like, in the...
Oh, yeah.
That kind of, like, minimalist city where everybody's just wearing, like, a black jumpsuit. But yeah, I totally
it's
see Stereolab.
You bring up minimalism.
I totally see Stereolab music. Okay,
like a Japanese and Chinese design. A Japanese design is definitely more minimalistic. Like when I was in San Francisco, if you go to Chinatown, it's very gritty. There's all these different complex colors and signage. And if you go to like Japantown, it's very minimalistic and clean.
Yeah, and very small, and the houses are small, and at least to some extent to tell the Americans they always have them show, come eat food and watch anime, or something. And that's the only thing, and then secret stuff goes on inside, but yeah, it's funny because when I think of Rabbit's Alt Left, I think of Stereolab. If you read or watch or listen to Stereolab, they play on this, their whole, you know, popularity in the 90s was pretending to be this, like, French pop records, and reintroducing it in this kind of Moog-like dream pop records, and it's.
Alex, weren't you saying that Michael Jackson was an alt-left icon?
Did I say that on the show?
Yeah, you did.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that was on when we were talking about that area in the California. That was like upscale.
Context.
It was like an upscale. It was like an upscale suburb, and someone made a joke about children running around and Michael Jackson. And yeah, I mean, I see Michael Jackson as being like emblematic. I mean, I think that was like a joke. I think what's funny, I don't even know why I said that. I mean, he flirts with like fascist imagery. I think Michael Jackson is just alt-right. I think he's just alt-right.
Well,
terms are just becoming like, they're just sort of eating each other at this point. It's like,
on a previous show, like someone said, like the goal of all these like new right figures is to have this utopia of a bunch of like blonde teenagers of both genders just like skinny dipping.
Yeah, that like, I mean pool.
That's weird.
That's kind of like, I mean, James O'Meara has that all manor bun thing of like a bunch of young white guys running around in rainbow thongs and like a wreckage
like all the like Antifa, like they always say like Hitler Youth was like really homoerotic, but maybe they were onto
they do it for insultive reasons, but it sounds like a multicultural thing they would rather want to live or something really strange. You know, it's funny, in one Asian studies class I had, one silly multicultural thing they tried to do, I had to read this book, Hip Hop in Japan. And they only talked about one guy, DJ Crush, and they talked about the Akinawanan lifestyle and loosely connected it with Gangoro prostitutes and brown skin. But it was this very outrageous theory that say, you see, black culture can be Japan. But the argument was really loose and kind of happy-dappy.
You bring up like those dark prostitutes. I've read like on these different blogs, a lot of guys who like travel to Asia to sleep with like prostitutes, like they always comment that like the darker the prostitute are, the cheaper they are.
Yeah, I mean,
they're explicitly racist there.
Yeah, it's true. I think they look frown upon dark skin, and dark skin probably means American. It probably means being wild. It's like you're an animal, and animals do animal things like sex and fun, and they break Confucius order. They don't want to listen to – they want to stick out if you have dark skin. And there's all these things to consider in that mind frame. So, you know, it's funny that – you know, it's funny. I'm thinking of thinking if there's a joke on Sam Hyde. I was recently looking at the Million Dollar Extreme Reddit, and on October the 17th, a long time ago, Sam Hyde was pretending to be this steampunk character, and he basically was, I tried all the women in the world, and the Chinese women were the best kind of women to be with. And then the mom knocks the door, and he shuts off the video, but he's doing these strange impressions, and he figures out Chinese women are the best. I don't know. I just think there's that there's that subtle influence of saying that if you want to try any women, so it's Asian women that are the interesting part.
That show Tim and Eric? Aren't they kind of vaporwave?
Oh, yeah. I like Tim and Eric. I saw Tim and Eric, too. They're actually from Philadelphia. I saw them some time ago. They're really cool, too. I don't know what to say about Eric Wareheim's music videos. I really love Depeche Mode. And when he did that video for Hold a Feed, I had no idea that was Eric Wareheim. I was like, this is such an ugly video, and this is under Depeche Mode? And it turns out it was Eric Wareheim. I'm like, oh, geez, this is bad. I don't know. I'm just not into that. And then he did more of Mr. Wazzo for his song Ham. That kind of made sense. But at the same time, I think Sarah Silverman also used Eric Wareheim's art for some weird Jewish deconstruction interests to say, ooh, wacky, don't follow your parents. You know, it's interesting, but yeah, I do like Tim and Eric in some respect.
We're at the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap things up?
I'd just like to say that right now I'm kind of writing my book on Asian Aryanism. My title is probably going to be, Almond Eyes, Baby Face. That's kind of my working title. I'm probably going to self-publish on Lulu. I might find a publisher for it. I do blog at Neomaya.
Is it going to be a fiction novel?
It's going to be a bunch of short story collections and some of my writing. It'll run from commentary to, it's going to be definitely short story collections. Kind of romantic, kind of like this. I'll definitely have to talk more about it once it's out, but I'll upload some of my stuff on my Blogspot. Check out my SoundClouds if you have to. YTMD.com users pill eater. I will be on there until the very end, until YTMD's out. And you can also check out my YouTubes on Pizza Dog. And recently I tried to get on Gab AI, the frog Twitter thing. And I've been writing under pill eater. So I'm just trying that out, seeing what that's like. Putting my name on random places. But I'm just writing out, and hopefully I can establish something in the future.
Pill Eater, thanks for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you very much, Robert. It's nice to be on.
And also, thanks, Alex.
Great to meet you. Hopefully we can talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks, guys.